So we're glad that you're here. And David is back with us. And Kyle, can you let him lead us in prayer?
To God and Father in heaven, we're thankful for this another Lord's Day that you have blessed us with. We're thankful for the time that we have to assemble together to study from your word and to worship you. We would ask your blessings on Josiah this morning as he teaches us, that you'll give him a clear mind to recall those things that he is prepared to say. And help us to search your scriptures with him and take those things that we find and use them in our lives and share them with others as well. Father, we're mindful of those that we know that are sick and in need of healing, and we'd ask that your healing hand be upon each one, if that be your will. Father, we're so thankful for all that you do, but the greatest gift of all is the gift of your Son. We're so thankful for that and the hope that that gives us to be with you for all eternity, where we can praise you forever and ever. It's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.
It's great to see you, Samuel.
Well, good morning. If you'll be turning over to Zephaniah, like Dad said, we'll just be overviewing Zephaniah this morning. Thank you so much for all the help that you have been to us, all of the prayers that you have offered. We really appreciate it. It's been about 2 years since I've been in the area, been in the building, and it's so nice to see everyone. I was hearing about Lloyd yesterday, and it's just so good to see some people who were here even when I was here over the summer about 21 years ago. Only a few of us left from that time. Actually, we had a class on the Minor Prophets, and we only got through Zephaniah, so I feel like we're picking up where we were 21 years ago. So when it comes to overviewing Zephaniah, we want to do a few things at the beginning. We want to talk about who Zephaniah the prophet is. We want to talk about his situation historically, and then possibly the date of the book before we get into some of the details of the book. So let's read verse 1. Someone read for us verse 1 with all of the names. Zephaniah 1 and verse 1.
The word of the Lord which came to Zephaniah, son of Cushi, son of Gedaliah, son of Amariah, son of Hezekiah, in the days of Josiah, son of Ammon, king of Judah.
Okay, so first of all, thinking about the prophet himself, when you think about the introduction to prophetic books, particularly the minor prophets, sometimes we know very little about the prophet, right? Sometimes it doesn't mention anything but their father's name or where they're from or some little detail like that. Here, Zephaniah is rather extensive in going back 4 generations to the time of Hezekiah. Why do you think that is? Can you think of a Hezekiah that was famous? You've already gone over these verses, right? So this is a softball question. Hezekiah, the king of Judah, is probably who is being referred to here, right? So this makes Zephaniah the cousin of Josiah. Some prophets like Isaiah seem to be particularly important in the royal court. Zephaniah maybe has an in the royal court, and because of that, he comes and he's speaking with Josiah. And in just a moment, as we think about the date, that may be incredibly important. Maybe it is his cousin, Zephaniah, who really encourages Josiah in his reforms. The name Zephaniah, though, is interesting in the context of the book. Most of the time when parents are naming their children, they have an idea in mind, right? You think about Genesis chapter 5, verses 28 to 29, where Noah is called Noah, because Lamech is worried about the restoration of the land and recovering from the curse. And so he names him Noah because it sounds like God's compassion. And so he's hoping that God will have compassion on the people and comfort them. And that's the reason he names his son Noah. Perhaps the same thing is going on here. The parents of Zephaniah name him Zephaniah. If you have a note perhaps in your Bible, Zephaniah means the Lord hides, Yahweh hides. It may be, well, what is a scenario that you can think of during the time of Manasseh and Ammon? What are some terrible things that are going on that would make some parents fearful for the lives of their children?
I think Chemosh is mentioned at various places, so it makes me think of sacrificing children, infants, to these false gods.
Okay. So you think about 2 Kings 21 and verse 6, among other places, Manasseh is offering a lot of children in child sacrifice. Now, there's a question about this, but at least it's possible that in 2 Kings 21 and verse 16, all the innocent blood that Manasseh is shedding is the children that he is offering in child sacrifice. If that is the case, then the parents of Zephaniah are much like the parents of Moses, right? They're hiding their son from a ruler who's trying to kill him. What's interesting is in Exodus chapter 2, verses 2 and 3, actually the word from which Zephaniah is built here appears in the story of Moses. They kind of Zephaniah Moses, hide him from Pharaoh. And now perhaps Zephaniah's parents are doing the same thing. Just a couple of generations before, again in the same family, you've got Joash being hidden in the temple because a ruler, in that case, a usurper, Athaliah, is trying to kill all of the king's sons in the line of David. So Zephaniah perhaps is very similar to Joash as well. He's a Moses character. He's like Joash, and his parents, as they are trying to protect him from some of the idolatry around them, they name their son this. But Zephaniah will actually pick up on the fact that his name means this in chapter 2. So we'll come back to this idea, Lord willing, in just a moment. So what is the historical situation of Zephaniah's prophecy? As you know, the most powerful nation in the world at this time is Assyria, right? During the time of Josiah, though, they become quite weak. They're facing trouble from all directions. So Elam, Babylon, the mountainous tribes in the north, some of the Arab tribes, and then Palestinian states, all of them are kind of rebelling during the time of Josiah. And so Assyria is getting much weaker. But at the same time, Assyria is powerful until about 627, the time that Jeremiah begins to prophesy. Ashurbanipal is king of Assyria up until that time. And once Ashurbanipal dies, then Babylon and the other Mesopotamian powers really cause Assyria trouble, and Assyria never really recovers. So it's a downhill climb from about 627, really to 609, that the Assyrians are plummeting off the world stage. But as we'll see in just a moment, it's also hard to tell, because of the power structure of the ancient Near East at that time, who's next. Right? Egypt has just thrown off Assyria just a couple of years before, the Assyrian yoke. So Egypt is pretty powerful. Babylon is not really yet. The Medes and the Persians probably are a better, not united at this time, but either one of them probably are a better guess as far as who's next on the world scene. And we'll talk about this in just a moment, but you'll notice that Babylon does not appear in the book of Zephaniah. Babylon does not appear. So Josiah is the king in verse 1. What's a little bit about Josiah? Okay, he's very young, right? How young is he when he becomes king? Okay, he's 8 years old. So he's probably not really the power behind the throne in the first couple of years, right? Somebody else is probably calling the shots. When you think about the chronology of kings in particular, what year is it when it really seems like Josiah becomes conscious and starts changing things in Judah? The 18th year, Okay, Second Chronicles mentions the eighth year that he starts cleaning up some things, but it's probably the 18th year. So about 622 BC when he starts to really, really reform Judah. Again, if Assyria has been kind of falling for about 5 years at this period, he's having a lot more independence. He's able to do a lot more. And so he begins to expand in Chronicles even to the northern parts of his territory into Israel because of the Assyrian weakness. So the question becomes, though, when does Zephaniah prophesy? In the time of Josiah. Sometimes, if you read commentaries, you will see that a lot of times they will discount the information at the beginning of a prophetic book, right? This is a superscription added later by scribes to kind of fit everything into a certain context. So the question then becomes, critically speaking, when you read the book of Zephaniah, does it make sense with what you would expect to be true in the time of Josiah from the book of Kings, right? Well, it does. Zephaniah chapter 1, all of the idolatry, you would expect that from the reigns of Manasseh and Ammon. You would expect that from the reforms of Josiah. And then the power of Assyria, if you look in chapter 2, the last verses of chapter 2, verses 13 to 15, deal with Assyria. They're still in power, which again goes with what you would expect generally during the period of Josiah. The Babylonians are not specifically mentioned. What I think makes the most sense is that Zephaniah is prophesying before Josiah's full reforms in his 18th year. So if that is the case, then Zephaniah is encouraging the people, he's encouraging the king to start the reform. So what you have with Zephaniah and Josiah is kind of like what you have with in the days of Ezra 5 when Zerubbabel and Jeshua are wanting to reform. But what are the two prophets in Ezra 5 verses 1 and 2 that then begin to encourage the people to reform and rebuild the temple and so forth?
Haggai and Zechariah.
Okay. The next prophetic books in the minor prophets, right? So they will encourage the people. Zephaniah may be doing the same thing here. He's encouraging Josiah. He's encouraging the people. These are the problems. You need to start fixing it. Josiah does start fixing some of these issues in his eighth year, but by his 18th year, he is fully committed after finding the book of the law. Some people think that Zephaniah is prophesying, of course, after the reforms. And the issue then becomes that Manasseh's sin, as Kings talks about and as Jeremiah talks about, was so bad that it could not avoid destruction. And Zephaniah is simply seconding that message if he's coming after Josiah's reforms. I think, though, that he's coming before his reforms because of this reason. Again, Babylon doesn't appear in the book. Why is that a big deal? It's what? Okay, it is before the first wave of exiles. And Babylon's power is really cannot be guessed at this particular period. He simply knows that trouble is coming from the north. And he's not alone in that, though. Most of the prophets who are contemporary with Zephaniah feel the same way. When you're reading the book of Jeremiah, the first 20 chapters, who's the enemy? The boys from the north, right? And then in chapter 21, he says it's Babylon, and he kind of changes and focuses on Babylon. But up until that point, he's not quite sure. As a matter of fact, he mentions Assyria several times in the first couple of chapters. I think Jeremiah probably thinks it's going to be Assyria. But then, obviously, it is Babylon when the picture changes. The same is true in the previous book, right? In Habakkuk chapter 1, of course, the prophet is complaining that the people are living in violence, and he wants God to do something. And God says, I am doing something. But it's shocking. It's surprising. It's not the enemy that you would expect. So it's the Chaldeans, it's the Babylonians in chapter 1 and verse 6 of Habakkuk. That is the enemy who I am bringing against you. But he's surprised that that would be the one that God is going to raise up. In other words, before about 625, 620, it's kind of shocking to think about Babylon being the next power. And so Zephaniah seems to be prophesying at the same time that Habakkuk and Jeremiah are, and they're not quite sure who will be the next power. God is only revealing that the enemy will be to the north. It's going to be the Mesopotamian, some Mesopotamian power who will come and destroy the people. So the contemporary prophets, for sure, are Jeremiah and Habakkuk. Who's another minor prophet that is probably one of Zephaniah's contemporaries? Yes, yes. So hard to date Nahum, but either 663, when in chapter 3 and verse 8, Thebes is destroyed, and about 612 when Nineveh is destroyed. It's got to be sometime between that period. So he's probably prophesying around the same time, maybe a little bit before Zephaniah. But that means that Ezekiel and Daniel are not contemporaries. They're later on in the period when it's clear that Babylon is the enemy, and they are in Babylon in each case, Ezekiel and Daniel. What's also interesting to me, reading back through Zephaniah yesterday, it's amazing how many times Zephaniah and his contemporary prophets are saying the exact same thing. The exact same thing. Now, as you read through Zephaniah, you'll realize there's a lot of places where he is referring to other prophets. You think of chapter 1 and verse 17, for instance. They're going to walk around like the blind. You think of Isaiah 59. Their silver and their gold won't deliver them. In chapter 1 and verse 18, you think of Isaiah 2. So there's several times that he's using previous prophets as well. But there's a couple of times where Jeremiah particularly and Habakkuk come into play in the account of Zephaniah. So look in Zephaniah chapter 1, verses 2 and 3. I will utterly remove everything from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. I will utterly remove man and beast. I will utterly remove the birds of the heavens and the fish of the sea and the rubble with the wicked. I will cut off mankind from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. This is a decreation event, right? All of the things in Genesis 1 that have been created are being taken away. This same picture appears in Jeremiah chapter 4, verses 23 to 26. And actually, the phrase that begins verse 2 is very unique in Hebrew, and it only appears in Zephaniah 1:2 and in Jeremiah chapter 8 and verse 13. They're using the exact construction. So this is a time where Zephaniah and Jeremiah are very close to each other. You also, if you look in verse 12, Zephaniah is told to go search the streets of Jerusalem. Anyone he can find, he's going to judge. Jeremiah was told in Jeremiah 5 to go search the streets of Jerusalem to try and find someone who was righteous, but he cannot, which of course is what leads to Zephaniah having to go out and search for everyone. So there's a few times that the language of Zephaniah and Jeremiah are very similar. Habakkuk is also true. Look in Zephaniah chapter 1 and verse 7. Hush before the Lord. You remember in Habakkuk chapter 2 and verse 20 where everyone is to hush because the Lord is in his holy temple. Zephaniah describes some of the officials in chapter 3 and verse 3 as being evening wolves. A description that also appears to describe the Babylonians in Habakkuk chapter 1 and verse 8. So you get the idea. Zephaniah and his contemporary prophets are saying the same thing. A judgment is coming. It's coming from an enemy in the north. God is upset with the people because of specifically their idolatry. So let's think about that aspect of Zephaniah's presentation for just a moment. Zephaniah is upset with the people for their idolatry. So look in chapter 1. Most of the description of idolatry is in verses 4 to 6. Who are some of the gods mentioned here in verses 4 to 6? Okay, Baal. Yes. We'll come back to that in verse 5, Milcom. And one more group, not by name, but group. Okay, idolatrous priests, that's a good point. How about verse 5? Okay, the host of heaven. Yes. Yes, some translations perhaps limit this to the stars, probably the sun, the moon, and the stars. All of these things are being worshipped. So there's a lot of idolatry going on. Again, this makes sense with the period of Josiah. Manasseh has brought a lot of idols into the temple. Ammon continues the idolatry of his father. So Josiah is having to clean up a lot of the idolatry. Also, though, you will notice in verses 4 and 5, there's an emphasis that part of the issue is religious syncretism, right? People are worshiping God. Yeah, they're worshiping God. But they're just adding other gods too, right? So notice the language of verse 4. God is going to remove in the last part of verse 4 the idolatrous priest with the priest. That term idolatrous priest only appears three times in the Old Testament. One in Hosea 10 and one in 2 Kings 23. And in each case, it talks about a priest who is ministering to either the calf in Hosea 10 that Jeroboam has made, or in 2 Kings 23, to the host of heaven and to Baal. So they are priests associated with the worship of other gods in the other cases that they're mentioned. But he also then mentions the priests. Now, the word priest can refer to illegitimate priest. You think of Judges 17 and 18. But it usually refers to priests who are serving in the temple of the Lord at Jerusalem. Both of them are active in the land. We've got priests that are devoted to Baal and the host of heaven and all of these other gods. And then we've got priests devoted to the Lord. Both of it going on at the same time. About 30 years ago, I guess it was, there was an inscription found in the northern part of Israel that says, to Yahweh and to his Asherah. So there's clearly a lot of worship of different gods associated with the worship of the Lord going on in Israel at this time. Look in verse 5, though, as well. Do you notice the exact phrase that describes people worshiping the host of heaven describes people worshiping the Lord? They bow down or they worship the host of heaven. They bow down and they worship the Lord. They're doing both. The same is true with those who swear. They're swearing by the Lord and they're swearing by Malcolm in verse 5. They're doing both. That's the problem. They are not exclusively devoted to the Lord. That is the problem in the days of Zephaniah and in the days of Josiah. They think they're okay because they're worshiping the Lord, but they're also worshiping the other gods. Kind of a situation like Athens, right? To the unknown God, they don't want to miss anybody, so they're worshiping all the gods at the same time. Let's look at that phrase, though, at the end of verse 5. The God Malcolm, or is it Milcom in your translation? Who has Malcolm? Malcolm in their translation. Nobody? Okay. That's a better transliteration here. So what happens is, that is the term that means their king, okay? Their king. But because of the consonants, if you add different vowels, you get Milcom, which, how many of us have Milcom in verse 5? Okay, almost everybody. Turn to 1 Kings chapter 11. This is obviously the context of Solomon worshiping many foreign gods because of the wives that he has married. So let's read verse 5. Someone read for us verse 5 of 1 Kings 11.
For Solomon went after Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the detestable idol of the Ammonites.
Okay, so this is the god of the Ammonites, right? And so most of the time when Malcom appears in the Hebrew text, they'll change the vowels, they'll change the vowels to make it Milcom because of this verse. Who is Milcom? Well, let's keep reading. Someone read verse 7 for us.
Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable idol of Moab, on the mountain which is east of Jerusalem, and for Molech, the detestable idol of the sons of Ammon.
Okay, did you notice that? Who's the god of the Ammonites in verse 5? Milcom, right? Who's the god in verse 7? Molech. Now, what seems to be going on here is this is one of those times where the scribes have changed the pronunciation of what the god's name would have been, okay? Nobody would have called him Molech. This is a mixture. This is kind of like if you've heard of the term Jehovah, right? It's a mixture of two different Hebrew words. It's not a real term. It doesn't exist. But it's a mixture of the vowels of one term and the consonants of another. The same thing is going on here. This is the consonants of the root that means to reign or to rule. Most of the time, you think of Melech, king, right? Melchizedek, Melech, king. So this term is probably originally, he's the king. There is a point to this in Zephaniah, so hang in there. He is the king. But they have put the vowels of shame on his name so that whenever you read it, you should read Boshet, right? Shame. This is actually the god of shame. This is not the king. This is the god of shame. The scribes do this often where they don't preserve the exact pronunciation of the name of this god because it doesn't matter, right? That god doesn't matter. Only our god matters. So they mock this god. But then you have cases like this, which clearly the term originally was king. And in the context of Zephaniah then, part of the issue is you're serving the wrong king. Here you are worshiping Baal. Here you are worshiping the king of the Ammonites. But notice in chapter 3 and verse 15, when God restores Judah and the nations to himself, the Lord will take away judgment, will take away the enemies, the people won't have to fear. And who is the Lord in chapter 3 and verse 15 of Zephaniah? He's the king. You've been worshiping the wrong king. Your king has caused all of this trouble to come upon you. You're afraid. Your enemies are coming to you. Your land is being destroyed. You've been worshiping the wrong king. But now, if you turn back to the Lord, the real king, if you turn back to the Lord, the real king, he will bless you. The king's sons in chapter 1 and verse 8 are failing you. The king that you're trusting in, who is an idol in chapter 1 and verse 5, is failing you. The Lord himself is the king that you are looking for. Quit looking for another king. Turn back to the Lord. So this is part of Zephaniah's point. You would hope that in the midst of this idolatry, that the leaders would be pulling Israel and Judah back to the Lord. Israel has been destroyed in 2 Kings 17 because of what? What one thing? Idolatry. And then it warns at the end of 2 Kings 17 that Judah is slipping down this same path and they're going to be destroyed for the same reason, right? And now here we are, almost 100 years after the time that Israel has been carried into Assyrian captivity. The Assyrians won't be around much longer. Israel has been destroyed, but the people of Judah are continuing in their idolatry, so another nation will be raised up to destroy them. You would hope in the midst of this that the leaders would be moving the people closer to the Lord, but they're not. Chapter 1 and verse 8, part of the problem is that the officials and the leaders are moving them closer to idolatry. He rebukes the officials and the king's sons. Incidentally, that may be significant in the context of Josiah's early reign. Again, it's the king's sons. He doesn't mention anything about the king throughout this chapter, throughout this section, outside of verse 1, right? It is the time period, if you're trying to date it, it is the time period when Josiah is officially king. But he's really not a factor throughout the rest of the book. It's the king's sons, the royal house, the officials in chapter 1 and verse 8. Look in chapter 3. Chapter 3 and verse 3, again, the officials have come into the land and they're like lions. Her judges are like wolves. In verse 4, her prophets and her priests are treacherous and they profane the things that are holy and do violence to the law. The prophet should be speaking the message of the Lord. The priest should be mediating between the people and God. The judges should be dispensing God's law and God's justice. The officials should be writing their own copy of the law and reading it, right? These people should be leading people closer to God, but instead they're leading them farther away from God and making the problem worse. So idolatry is the issue. The leaders are the issue because they're not turning the people back to God. So what is God going to do about this? The Lord is going to judge the people. Look in chapter 2 and verse 3. There's two verses in Zephaniah that are rather interesting. God shows his justice and righteousness by judging wickedness. That's part of what Habakkuk is about. All of this wickedness around, the prophet says, and God said, I know, I see, I'm bringing justice to judge the wickedness. In chapter 2 and verse 3, the Lord does just commands. You see that in chapter 2 and verse 3. The Lord does just. In chapter 3 and verse 5 of Zephaniah, chapter 3 and verse 5, the Lord within her is righteous. That's a legal term. He does what is right. He does no injustice. Every morning he shows forth his justice. Every dawn he does not fail. But the unjust knows no shame. Of course, you think of the words of Lamentations 3, 22 and 23 about God's mercy every morning. But this is God's justice every morning, right? God's justice every morning. So God, in his justice, is going to have to deal with the idolatrous people of Israel, the people who have rejected him. He's going to have to take care of this. And in each case, in Zephaniah, he emphasizes the fact that God is not just arbitrarily judging people, but that he's doing so in justice. So the punishment fits the crime. In chapter 1 and verse 4, the priests are part of the problem, right? The priests are part of the problem. So in chapter 1 and verse 7, God is going to prepare a sacrifice. The word prepare rearranges the consonants of priest, right? You can see the priest in the fact that God is preparing this sacrifice. The priests have constantly prepared sacrifices and offerings, and now God is preparing the priest because of their rebellion. He's going to sacrifice them. The punishment fits the crime. Speaking of that, the day of the Lord. Now, the day of the Lord is very common in the prophets. But how is the day of the Lord actually described in Zephaniah? It's not necessarily a day that's coming quickly or surprisingly. It's a day that you've seen for a long time coming. It's going to be terrifying when it comes. But what's the emphasis? The day of the Lord is going to be what? A sacrifice. The day of the Lord is a sacrifice. Now, this is not unique to Zephaniah. You can think of other prophetic texts. If you want to jot one down, Isaiah 34 and verse 6 is one place that the day of the Lord is a sacrifice. But why a sacrifice? In this context, with the trouble with idolatry, why is the day of the Lord specifically a sacrifice? I think it's probably because this has been part of the problem of the kings previously. Manasseh and Ammon are sacrificing to all these other gods. They're sacrificing children. Anytime you worship another god, part of the worship of another god is sacrifice. So they've spent a lot of time sacrificing their children and animals to these other gods. Because they have devoted themselves through sacrifice to these other gods, God will judge them through sacrifice. They will be judged. There's another thing that's quite interesting here, though. The word for sacrifice is usually the word that describes a peace offering. So when you offer a sacrifice and you eat part of it to show that you have fellowship with God, right? This sacrifice that should have showed the proximity of the people to God is now going to show their distance, right? It actually shows their proximity to idols instead of to God. Israel was called to eat the sacrifice of the Passover in Exodus 12 and verse 27. And they sacrificed peace offerings in Exodus 24 and verse 5 in order to make a covenant with the Lord. But now there's a different sacrifice that God is going to offer, not showing that he's protecting the people as you would expect in the Passover, not showing that he has a relationship with them, not showing that everything is peace. But now his justice is coming, and he is sacrificing them, which is fitting. So God's judgment against Judah is fitting. Look now at the nations. He also judges the nations. God is God of the universe. He judges the nations, and his judgment against them is fitting. If you look in chapter 2 and verse 4, he begins with the Philistines. Particularly, verses 4 to 7 have a lot of puns that show that the judgment is fitting the crime. Gaza will be deserted. Gaza and deserted are almost identical terms. The city will be deserted, as you would expect, as is fitting. Ekron, at the end of verse 4, is uprooted. Again, uprooted and Ekron are almost identical terms. The judgment fits, the punishment fits the crime. In verse 5, the Cherethites, literally those who are cut off, will be destroyed in verse 5. And the verb destroyed often appears in passages like Ezekiel 25 and verse 16 with the verb to cut off. The Cherethites, the cut off ones, will be cut off. Ezekiel 25 and verse 16 also connects the Cherethites with the Philistines. But then in verse 6, he said they're going to be cut off, they're going to be destroyed, and the only thing that's going to be left is going to be pasture land. Do you see that in verse 6? This is a unique term for pasture land. Doesn't appear anywhere else in the Old Testament. Most people believe that it is a misspelling of another word. But it has the same consonants as the Cherethites. The Cherethites will be completely cut off, and the only thing that will be left is pasture land. The punishment fits the crime. Why is God judging the nations? For the same reason that he's judging Israel, because of idolatry. But a little bit differently, if you look in chapter 2 and verse 15, the idolatry is self-centered. Assyria, Nineveh, says of themselves, in her heart, I am and no one else exists. Can you think of anyone else who could claim I am and no one else exists? Right? Now it's not the same as Exodus chapter 3, verses 14 and 15. The syntax is different, and I think that's part of the point. They're a cheap imitation of the real thing. Again, if you want a king, don't choose Molech. If you want the real I am, don't choose Assyria. Don't choose cheap imitations for the real thing. The great I am can help you. The real king can help you. Don't trust in anything else. Assyria is claiming to be God and irreplaceable. And yet, ironically, probably in just a couple of years after Zephaniah's prophecy, Assyria will basically be finished. They will not exist. Look in chapter 2 and verse 11, though. How long do we have? It's almost 10. Okay. In the midst of the judgment against the nations, so in chapter 1, God is upset with the people of Judah because of their idolatry. In chapter 2, he then is judging the nations, beginning in chapter 2 and verse 4 through the end of the chapter. In the middle of this section, though, as he deals with the Philistines, as he deals with Ammon and Moab, as he deals with Assyria and Cush, then in verse 11, in the midst of all of this, he says this: "The Lord will be awesome against them, for he will famish all the gods of the earth, and to him shall bow down each in its place all the lands of the nations." In the midst of God's judgment against the nations, the question that would be on most people's mind in the 7th century is, if your God was really powerful, wouldn't he have stopped the Assyrians? I mean, wasn't that the Assyrian argument in 2 Kings 18 and 19? If God was really powerful, wouldn't he have stopped us from taking Samaria? Wouldn't he have stopped us before we took the 46 cities of Judah? Your theology is off. How do you respond when Judah is a very weak nation at this time, and Israel has already been taken into captivity, and all of the other nations' gods seem to be protecting them? How do I compute this, right? God's response through Zephaniah is, all the other gods worship me, why don't you? The Lord is feared. The Lord is feared over them. This prepositional phrase usually describes something being greater than or above something. The Lord is feared over the other gods in verse 11. And then it says that God my translation says famish. This is the ESV 2011 edition. It says that the Lord famished all the gods of the earth. But this phrase only appears a couple of times, and it appears like with the sheep in Ezekiel 34, where some of the sheep are thin. They're gaunt, okay? There's not much left to them. There's not much to eat, remember, in that passage. And the bigger sheep are becoming fat by pushing them out of the way. These other gods are dwindling away, are becoming weak, are wasting away to nothing. They can't find their own food. They can't survive on their own. They're dependent upon God, is the imagery. Just like God feeds the ravens, he's got to feed the other gods. They're not strong enough to take care of themselves. And notice what the other gods are doing. The gods will bow down to him. Look in chapter 1 and verse 5. The people right now are bowing down to the host of heaven and to the Lord. They're thinking the Lord is not enough, and so they're trusting and bowing down to other gods. But here, all of the gods bow down to God. Don't trust in Assyria, the fake I am. Don't trust in Molech, the fake king. Don't trust in any of the gods. All of them are fake. All of them worship God. They bow down to him. It says, each in his place, all the nations, all the lands of the nations. This may be a reference to Deuteronomy 32 and verse 8, where God has given the angels charge of different areas. But all of these angels worship God. They're dependent upon God. The gods are nothing. They worship God. If these gods that you are worshiping worship God, shouldn't you be worshiping God too, right? If Molech worships the real king, shouldn't you be worshiping the real king? If the host of heaven realize that God is the one who has created them and they're dependent upon him, shouldn't you be worshiping God as well? It's interesting, in the next books of the minor prophets, the idea of bowing down does not appear very often in the minor prophets, though we've seen it twice here in Zephaniah. But the book of Zechariah closes with a picture of all of the nations who survive. They have fought against God, and they survive, and they realize they must come to Jerusalem and bow down before the real God. In Zechariah chapter 14, verses 16 and 17. And notice in that case, again, it emphasizes that the Lord is king. The people need to realize who the real king is in Zechariah chapter 14, verses 16 and 17, and bow down to him. What passage, this is a tricky question, and you're going to come up with all kinds. What passage do you think of in the Psalms when you think of the gods worshiping the Lord? Yes, thank you. So it wasn't that hard. Psalm 97 and verse 7. Psalm 97 and verse 7. All the worshipers of images are put to shame. This word shame is the verbal form from which we get the word boshet that I mentioned earlier. It's usually associated with Baal worship, and it's also associated with Molech. So gods like Baal, you think about personal names like Ish-Baal that's changed to Ish-Boshet, right? Gods like Baal, he's worth nothing. He's shameful. Molech is Molech, that is shame, not Melech, king. All worshipers of images are put to shame who make their boast in worthless idols. And then, of course, the call in verse, at the last part of verse 7, worship him, all you gods. Worship him, all you gods. Now, of course, you're familiar with the fact that the Greek, instead of gods, has angels there. And this passage appears in Hebrews chapter 1, doesn't it? When God tells the Father, tells the angels to worship the Son. The Father tells the angels to worship the Son. All the gods worship the Lord. The people of Judah need to do the same. We need to do the same. The Lord's judgment on the nations is meant to get Judah's attention. In Zephaniah chapter 3, verses 6 and 7, the point of God's judgment against the nations was to wake Judah up, just like his judgment on Israel in 2 Kings 17 is to wake Judah up, give them another chance. Or Amos chapter 4, where God is judging Israel repeatedly so that they avoid greater levels of judgment later on. But it fails. The people will not listen. So God is coming in judgment. But in the midst of judgment, there is still hope. Chapter 2, verses 1 to 3. We haven't spoken much about the structure of Zephaniah, but isn't it fascinating? Chapter 1, the judgment against Judah. Chapter 2, the judgment against the nations. Chapter 3, verses 1 to 8, the judgment against all of the nations, including Judah. But then right in the middle of this, chapter 2, verses 1 to 3, the way to escape. The way to escape. He tells them to gather together in verse 1. Before everything happens, before the decree takes effect in verse 2, before the day passes like chaff, before there comes upon you the burning of the anger of the Lord, before there comes upon the day upon you the day of the anger of the Lord, before it's too late, right, this is what you should do in chapter 2 and verse 3. Seek the Lord, you humble of the land, who do his just commands. Seek righteousness, seek humility. Perhaps you may be hidden on the day of the anger of the Lord. Part of the problem with the people in chapter 1 and verse 6 was they weren't seeking the Lord. But now in chapter 2 and verse 3, if they will seek the Lord, they will be able to escape. Did you notice what term he used there? You will be hidden. What Zephaniah's name means? The Lord hides, right? He doesn't use the same word, but it's the same concept. What's interesting, though, is every other time that this verb appears in the Minor Prophets, it is negative. In Amos chapter 9 and verse 3, Israel cannot hide from God. Even if they went up to the top of Mount Carmel, they would not be able to hide from God. In Micah chapter 3 and verse 4, the Lord is going to hide his face because the leaders are so wicked, he will not listen to their prayer. You can't hide from God. As a matter of fact, God is turning away from you. He's hiding his face from you. And then in Hosea 13 and verse 14, death is coming, and God is going to hide his compassion. There's no hope. But here, for the first time in the Minor Prophets, after all of these references, I should note that a lot of people realize that the Minor Prophets probably should be read as a book. So if you're working your way through the book, right, and you see death is coming, there is no compassion is being hidden, there's no hope. I'm fleeing from God and there's no hope. God's turning his face away and hiding it, there's no hope. Then this is the last time that this verb to hide appears in the Minor Prophets. And Zephaniah says, if you seek the Lord, if you humble yourselves, this sounds familiar, doesn't it? Isn't there a verse in Chronicles about that? If you seek the Lord, if you humble yourself, then you will be hidden in the day of the anger of the Lord. There is a way of escape. There will be a remnant. There will be those who escape because they have trusted in God. And God even prophesies that in the midst of judgment. Did you see that as you're reading through Zephaniah? In Zephaniah chapter 2 and verse 7, he said, I'm going to restore their fortunes. This is a technical term for return from exile. So they're going into exile. They will be punished, but there's a way to escape. A remnant will escape. A remnant will survive. Now, with the last 30 seconds that we have, let's talk about the resurrection of the Lord in chapter 3 and the reversal of some of these aspects. God is going to give them in chapter 3 and verse 9 pure speech, pure speech. They have been calling on the name of other gods. So this is very similar to Hosea chapter 2, verses 16 and 17, where the Lord is removing the names of the Baals from the people's mouths. They're only going to be speaking the name of the Lord. God's purifying their speech so that they will only call on the Lord. And he's bringing his worshipers in chapter 3 and verse 10 from beyond Cush. Cush was judged in chapter 2 and verse 12 as being in opposition to the Lord, but now there will be worshipers, a remnant coming from that area. That's what's fascinating throughout Zephaniah. It's not just a remnant of Judah that will be returning to the Lord. It's all of the nations. God is God of all of the nations. He judges all of the nations. He brings all of the nations back to himself. Worshipers from Cush will come and submit to him. And those in verse 11 who turn back to God from Baal will no longer need to be ashamed. You needed to be ashamed if you worshipped Baal, but you will no longer need to be ashamed because you're worshiping the true God. And Judah rejoices in verse 15 because the Lord is their king, not Molech. They have the real king now. And the Lord is a great warrior who is able to save in chapter 3 and verse 17. Previously, their warriors in chapter 1 and verse 14 fled in fear because they couldn't stand against the wrath of God. But now the Lord, the great warrior, is coming to save his people. And in verses 10 and verse 18, God has an offering and a festival sacrifice, which makes you think about chapter 1, right? The day of the Lord was a sacrifice. But now the day of the Lord is a sacrifice in which God blesses the people. It was a terrifying thing earlier, but now it's a time for the people to share a meal with God and to see that they really do have fellowship. Chapter 3 and verse 17, as we close, the Lord is in your midst. That was the problem in chapter 1, right? The Lord was in their midst. They were sinful and God was coming against them. But now the Lord is in their midst and this is a blessing. So Zephaniah shows at the end of the book that the Lord is going to restore everything, to use the language of Joel, that the locusts have eaten. He's changing everything and restoring it because the people have repented. There is a way to escape the judgment of the Lord, and that is to seek the Lord humbly. Any other questions or comments? Yes, sir.
When we were going over chapter 2 and verse 5, verse 6, In my book, it says the seacoast will become pasture lands. I kind of saw that as a play on words of, with it being pasture lands, it's past your land.
Hmm. That is interesting. I hadn't thought about that. Thank you. It will not be their land anymore, and that's part of the point. Anything else? As everybody congregates in the back. All right, thank you.